Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take complex research and really try to give you that fast but thorough overview you need.
That's the goal.
And today we are focusing on something pretty devastating, an environmental stressor hitting the southeastern U.S. coast, the Florida red tide.
Right, FRT. We hear about these red tides, seems like every year now. And usually, the news focuses on the big stuff, the visible things, massive fish kills, closed beaches, awful stuff.
Yeah, the immediate impact.
Exactly. But the impact, it actually goes much deeper. So today we're going down to the molecular level. We want to understand how this event, which is caused by a specific dinoflagellate, Carinia brevis, and it's really potent breath toxins, how that affects a really vital organism there. The eastern oyster, Crassostrea virginica.
And the scale, you mentioned the visible impact, but the scale of this problem is just, it's immense. These harmful algal blooms, HABs, they're a global issue. But the Florida red tide specifically, we're talking higher mortality rates in marine life and annual economic losses. Well, they exceed $40 million in that region alone.
$40 million, yeah. It really puts a tangible weight on these microscopic changes we're about to talk about, doesn't it?
It really does.
And that's where the oyster becomes so important here. It's a filtered feeder, right? So it acts as a critical sentinel organism.
Okay, a sentinel.
Yeah, it basically monitors the environment for us. Oysters, they very rapidly accumulate these toxins in their tissues. And what makes this research, I think, so compelling is that the toxins aren't just poisonous in the general sense. They are specifically genotoxic.
Genotoxic.
Meaning they are physically capable of causing DNA damage. They can break the strands.
Wow. Okay, so let's unpack that. That DNA damage risk. Because when we think about how an organism survives a big environmental hit, like a flood of poison, we usually think genetics, right? The fixed blueprint. If you survive, your kids inherit your tough genes. Simple evolution.
A long game.
Right. But this kind of rapid acute stressor, it seems like it needs something faster than traditional evolution. So our mission today is really to look at epigenetics. How does a cell actually change its behavior without changing its fundamental DNA code?
That really is the core question here. Epigenetics is like the cell's dynamic response system.
Right.
It allows the organism to show different phenotypic changes, that how it physically looks and functions,
right,
based on modifications to gene expression. It's how the cell decides if a specific gene should be turned on or off, even when the underlying DNA sequence hasn't changed at all.
Okay, so give me an analogy. How should we picture this?
Well, think of the DNA as this enormous instruction manual.
Sure.
Right? Genetics is the actual ink printed on the page. It's fixed.
Right.
Epigenetics.
Yeah.
That's like the highlighting, the sticky notes, the bookmarks that tell the cell which pages to read right now and maybe which ones to ignore for the time being.
Ah, I like that. Highlighting and sticky notes. So it's a temporary reprogramming almost, designed to help the organism like acclimatize quickly and survive that immediate stress.
Precisely. Quick adaptation. Now let's look at the actual physical structures involved in that kind of reprogramming. You mentioned the instruction manual, the DNA. It's not just floating around, it's tightly packaged.
Right, it's wrapped around those proteins called histones, forming little spools, nucleosomes, I think they're called.
Exactly, nucleosomes. Water. And that whole DNA histone complex, that's called chromatin.
Chromatin, got it.
And the crucial point here is how tightly that DNA is wrapped. That determines accessibility for the cellular machinery.
So, tight wrap, genes off, loose wrap, genes on.
Pretty much. If it's wrapped tightly, the genes are generally silenced. If it's looser, they can be transcribed, they're active. And the cell controls this chromatin accessibility mainly through two primary dynamic chemical modifications that were investigated in this specific research.
Okay, what's the first one?
First involves modifications to the histone spools themselves. There are specialized sort of minority histone proteins called variants, things like H28X, H28Z, and macro H2A.
Okay, specialized variants, what do they do?
Well, these variants are specialized for really critical tasks, particularly things like maintaining genome integrity. Think of them as part of the cell's immediate repair crew.
The repair crew. Okay. And the second mechanism?
The second one is DNA methylation. This is different. It's a direct chemical tag specifically. A methyl group added to a cytosine base right onto the DNA strand itself.
Okay. So if the histones control the wrapping, the methylation is more like putting a lock directly on the gene itself.
That's a great way to put it. Heavy methylation typically pushes that region of DNA towards a closed, tightly packed state. We call that heterochromatin, where transcription is repressed, locked down.
Okay.
Conversely, less methylation allows the region to open up, become euchromatin, making those genes accessible and active.
And what's really key here, you said these are dynamic.
Absolutely. Unlike the fixed genetic code, these epigenetic marks, the histone variants, the methylation, they are generally reversible. They can be added and removed. It's the cell's way of hitting a dynamic mute button or an activate switch in direct response to what's happening in the environments.
That makes perfect sense. These are the tools the oyster is potentially using to survive this red tide hit. So, okay, how exactly did the research team test this dynamic switch? Let's walk through the experiment they designed.
Right. So the researchers set up a really carefully controlled lab simulation.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just, you know, dump a load of toxins into a tank.
Right.
They specifically mimicked a typical medium to high intensity Florida red tide episode. They mirrored how a patch of this harmful algae, K. brevis, would actually approach and then engulf an oyster bed in the wild.
Ah, that dynamic exposure, that seems really important. So how did they do that?
They started with a very low concentration of K. brevis, just 5 cells per milliliter, which is quite low. And then they exponentially increased that concentration over time until it hit a peak of 1,000 cells per milliliter after 5 hours.
Mm.
That simulates the bloom intensifying.
And they took samples along the way.
Yes, they needed to capture the response curve. So samples were collected at 4 really critical time points. T0 was the baseline, before any exposure.
Right, the before picture.
Exactly. Then T1, which was 3 hours into this rising concentration. T2 was at the 5-hour mark, right at that peak toxin concentration.
Ooh, maximum stress.
Maximum stress, yeah. And finally, T3, which was collected 24 hours after the start, simulating a kind of recovery or, let's say, stabilization phase after that initial toxic wave had passed.
Okay, and which part of the oyster did they look at? Tissue choice must matter here.
It does. They focused on the gills.
Why the gills?
Well, for filter feeders like oysters, the gills are really the first line of contact with the water and anything in it, including these biotoxins. And previous work showed gills experienced pretty substantial DNA damage when exposed.
Makes sense. And controls. Did they make sure nothing else was causing the effects?
Oh, yeah. Very important. The controls were robust. The team confirmed the oysters were actively feeding on the K. brevis cells. You could see the cell counts decreasing in the tanks.
So they were definitely ingesting the toxin.
Confirmed. And they also carefully monitored water quality and successfully ruled out changes in things like oxygen or pH as potential confounding factors.
Uh-huh.
So the effects they saw were attributable to the brevtoxins from the K. brevis.
Okay, solid setup. Now we can finally dive into the results. Let's start with those specialized histone variants, H2AX, H2AZ, and macro H2A. I noticed the research really emphasizes that this is the first time the genes and the proteins for these variants have actually been described in the eastern oyster. That seems like a big deal in itself.
Oh, it's foundational work. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because think about it. Without knowing the normal blueprint for these critical proteins, you can't really assess the damage or the response accurately. Describing these genes for the first time gives us that essential baseline knowledge. It's about understanding how this absolutely crucial species, the oyster, actually repairs its own genetic structure. It's really the first step towards maybe creating health indicators we could use in wild populations down the line.
Okay, foundational. Yet the initial findings for these specific proteins were, well, maybe a bit counterintuitive. You'd sort of expect a genotoxic stressor to make the oyster crank out more of these repair crew proteins, right?
Might think so, yeah.
But the study found the exposure did not cause significant changes in the overall gene expression or the total protein levels of these three variants, H28X, H2AZ, or macro H2A, across those different time points.
Exactly. That was a bit surprising at first. It seemed the oyster wasn't necessarily building more repair vehicles, if you like that analogy.
Okay.
But the clue that something significant was happening, despite the lack of change in the total amount of protein, was the very high inter-individual variation they saw.
Variation between different oysters.
Yes, particularly in gene expression. For instance, they saw like a 2-fold difference in H2AX expression between oysters at just the T1 mark only 3 hours in. It suggested the system was definitely stressed and individual oysters were reacting, perhaps a bit chaotically, under the pressure.
Okay, so not more protein overall, but maybe something was happening to the protein that was already there?
Precisely. And this is where it gets really interesting. This is the aha moment, I think.
Yeah.
The researchers looked beyond just the amount of the protein. They looked at a specific modification applied after the protein was built, what's called a post-translational modification, or PTM.
PTM, okay.
Specifically, they looked at the phosphorylation of the H2AX variant. This modified form is known by the marker gamma H2AX, spelled BH2AX.
Gamma H2X. And what does that specific modification signify?
Well, gamma H2AX is considered a gold standard biomarker for DNA damage, especially for double-stranded DNA breaks, which are really dangerous for the cell.
Gold standard, okay. Why?
Because this phosphorylation happens incredibly rapidly, the gamma H28X signal accumulates very quickly, right in the damaged spots in the chromatin, effectively marking those double-strand breaks for immediate repair. It's like the cell's instantaneous high-priority alarm system for catastrophic DNA failure.
So if H28X is the repair truck, gamma H2AX is the flashing emergency light on top.
Exactly. That's a perfect analogy. It screams, damage here, fix now.
Okay, so did the red tide toxins successfully switch on those flashing lights? Did they ring that alarm bell?
Loudly and clearly, yes. The concentration of gamma H2AX increased significantly, and it mirrored the rising K brevis concentrations perfectly archeredly. It went up significantly at T1 and reached its peak at T2, right when the poxin concentration was highest.
Wow. Okay.
The alarm was definitely sounding at peak stress. And then, importantly, during that simulated recovery phase at T3, 24 hours in, the concentration showed a slight but statistically significant decrease. A promising sign maybe the repair was starting or the damage influx was slowing.
So this strongly confirms the genotoxic effect.
Without a doubt. It confirms that BREV toxins do cause this severe DNA damage in oysters, and crucially, it shows that the oyster's DNA damage response mechanism, using gamma H28X, is functional and highly responsive to this specific environmental toxin.
That is a huge step forward, potentially for coastal monitoring, right? We now have perhaps a clear, rapid molecular biomarker gamma H2A.X that we could potentially use to assess the health, the level of DNA damage in oyster beds under stress from red tides.
That's the potential application, yes. A direct measure of damage response.
Okay, fascinating. Let's transition now to the other major epigenetic shift they found. We've covered the specific alarm signal. Now let's look at the broader changes, the genome-wide DNA methylation patterns.
Right, so this moves us from that specific alarm system, gamma H28X, to thinking about the oyster's overall operating system, how it's managing its entire genome. They used a technique called MSAP, methylation-sensitive amplification polymorphism, to look at these broad patterns.
MSAP, okay, and what did that reveal?
It revealed significant differences in the overall methylation profiles. There was a clear separation between the oysters in the early stages, that's T0 baseline, and T1 early exposure compared to those in the later stages, P2 peak exposure, and T3 stabilization.
So a definite shift in the overall pattern as the red tide simulation progressed.
A definite shift, yes.
So what was the trend? Were the genes locking down more, getting more methylation, or were they opening up?
The primary trend, quite clearly, was an overall decrease in the global DNA methylation levels. As the simulation progressed, we call this hypomethylation.
Hypomethylation, less methylation overall.
Exactly. They observed a loss of these fully methylated DNA segments and, correspondingly, an increase in the unmethylated or hemimethylated, meaning only one strand was methylated states. This opening up was most pronounced during T2 and T3, the peak stress and recovery phases.
Wait a second. So the overall DNA is loosening up, becoming less methylated, more open, while the oyster is being hit with toxins that are actively damaging its DNA. Isn't that kind of risky? Opening things up when damage is happening?
That's an excellent question, and it does seem counterintuitive at first glance, doesn't it? Why make the genome potentially more vulnerable when it's under attack?
Yeah.
But interestingly, this pattern, this global hypomethylation, it's actually been observed consistently in many different organisms when they're responding to various kinds of environmental pollution and particularly oxidative stress, which BREV toxins are known to cause.
Okay, so it's a known stress response pattern, even if it seems risky.
It seems to be. The interpretation generally is that this large-scale opening up of the genome, this hypomethylation, might allow the oyster to rapidly modulate a wide range of stress-responsive genes all at once.
Okay, so it's not targeted, it's broad.
It's broad. Think of it like the cell, sort of, dropping some of its general access restrictions to quickly activate a whole suite of emergency coping mechanisms. It's like unlocking the entire instruction manual to rapidly find all the different pages related to detoxification, repair, and survival, even if doing so introduces some temporary instability across the board.
So it's sacrificing some baseline stability for the sake of a rapid, widespread emergency response.
That seems to be the prevailing hypothesis.
Yes.
Helps to make the whole picture clear, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The oyster is fighting the immediate, specific damage with that gamma H2AX alarm system.
Right, the flashing light.
While simultaneously trying to activate broader survival strategies by globally adjusting its epigenetic landscape through this hypomethylation.
Two levels of response happening at once.
Exactly. And we've seen, based on this research, really rapid and quite dramatic changes on both levels within just 24 hours of exposure to these red tide toxins.
Yeah.
This really captures the essence of epigenetic memory, doesn't it? It's a fast, flexible way for the organism to try and adapt to a sudden environmental challenge without having to wait generations for the much slower process of evolutionary change through genetics.
Okay, so let's try and summarize the core findings from this deep dive then. It seems the Florida red tide triggers a really rapid, two-pronged epigenetic response in these eastern oysters. Is that fair?
I think that's a very fair summary. Yes.
Okay, so prong one. We have that precise, specific DNA damage signal, the phosphorylation of H2A.X creating gamma H2A.X. And that serves as an immediate and potentially trackable biomarker of genotoxic stress.
Correct. The immediate alarm.
And prong two. We see this broader, more strategic regulatory shift across the whole genome, characterized by this global DNA hypomethylation, which seems designed to open up access to a wide range of survival-related genes all at once.
A system-wide emergency mode, exactly.
Okay.
And it's that second point, really, thinking about the potential long-term impact of that broad molecular shift that brings us to the provocative thought we want to leave you with today.
Ah, okay. Let's hear it.
Well, the research itself in the broader field of epigenetics suggests that these kinds of stress-induced epigenetic modifications, well, they are potentially susceptible to being transmitted across generations, transgenerational.
Passed down, without changing the DNA sequence itself.
That's the idea. They could form the basis for not just short-term acclimatization within one oyster's lifetime, but potentially influence longer-term adaptation over generations. So, given that this study showed such dramatic epigenetic responses, the damage signal, the global unlocking happening so quickly within just 24 hours of red tide exposure, we're left with a really critical and I think still largely unanswered question for the future of these coastal ecosystems.
Okay.
To what extent could these stress-induced epigenetic memories, this tendency perhaps towards hypomethylation or a primed damage response system acquired during a red tide event, actually be passed down to the next generation of oysters?
Mm-hmm.
And if they are passed down, how might that fundamentally alter the population's resilience or perhaps even its vulnerability to future red tides or other stressors in the long term?
Yeah.
All without any actual change happening in their fundamental genetic code, their DNA sequence.
Wow. So the environment potentially rewriting the operating instructions, not the hardware, and passing those tweaked instructions down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Think about the implications of that. The environment potentially changing how a species functions generation after generation through this epigenetic layer.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating area for future research.
It really is something definitely to think about long after this deep dive ends.